the jazz idiom.
Rooted in the blue-black soil of her Carolina girlhood, she was the diva. She could purr and roar. Uh-huh. She could dive and soar, and more.
That's poet Al Young talking about Nina Simone. We talk with him and photographer Charlie Robinson about the jazz greats they've known.
The F-22 fighter has a piece of it made in 45 U.S. states. Now, I only took Econ 101, but something tells me that that's not an efficient way to build an aircraft. But it is a smart way to build an aircraft if what you're looking to do is to build it in such a way that nobody can shut down the flow of money to your system.
And that's Eugene Jarecki talking about the American way of war. We'll talk with him later on in the show. But first, Al Young and Charlie Robinson on jazz. We first talked with Al Young last year about his book of poems, Something About the Blues. A jazz performer and poet, he moved out to the Bay Area of California in the early 1960s, just in time for the flowering of poetry and jazz in Berkeley. Now he's teamed up with his friend and fellow jazz fan, Charlie Robinson, to create a beautiful book and CD set celebrating the genre they both love. It's called Jazz Idiom, Blueprints, Stills, and Frames. The book showcases Charlie Robinson's intimate photographs of the jazz greats, among them Thelonious Monk, Dizzy Gillespie, and of course the great Nina Simone. In counterpoint to the images, Al Young riffs, scats, and bebops with his poetry, anecdotes, and insight into the players and the moments captured by the camera. Charlie Robinson was staff photographer of the Monterey Jazz Festival for several years. He took many of the photos there. Al Young is the outgoing poet laureate of California. He's authored more than 20 books of poetry, fiction, and nonfiction. I spoke to them both earlier this fall. Al Young and Charlie Robinson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Wonderful.
Pleasure to be here, for sure.
You have collaborated on this wonderful book, Jazz Idiom. You include some poetic takes and riffs, which are really nice. They're kind of, talk about how you see the music of the riffs in the writing that you do here with this, to accompany these wonderful photographs.
Well, Charles Robinson's photographs are so marvelous. They're straight-on photographs. He does not believe in using flash or anything intrusive. He'll tell you more about that than I can. But when you feel it, when you view these photographs, and most people don't give much thought to the relationship between photographer and subject, but in this case, you can always sense that there's a warm relationship. So it was very easy to bounce off of that verbally to imagine what might have been going on. And, of course, I had the advantage of having access to Charles directly.
Yeah, right.
And getting stories. There's always a story with the photograph, and that's not surprising because some of his favorite photographers come from that school of photojournalism.
The school of photojournalism. Well, actually, Charlie, your favorite artists are Vermeer.
Oh,
and
yes.
Henri Cartier-Bresson, okay. Henri Cartier-Bresson was a photographer, but Vermeer?
Vermeer was a Dutch painter, and I got enchanted with him long, long ago because of his use of light, the reality of his scenes, the depiction of everyday life. I mean, just casual sort of things, nothing manufactured. His faithfulness to the scene with respect to perspective, his point of view, and the kind of grabbing a moment, you know, documenting a moment. So, I mean, there are a lot of features in his painting that just kind of grabbed me from the standpoint of the reality of it.
And now he was a long time ago, in the 17th century.
Mm-hmm.
And say a little bit about Henri Cartier-Bresson. What inspires you about him?
Cartier-Bresson essentially was the guru for photojournalism from the standpoint of being in on scenes, recognizing the relationships between people, which Al just spoke to, how life is depicted in events, just day-to-day events, which to some people, if you don't tune into them, seem to be trite, when in fact they aren't, They always suggest and indicate the relationship that a group has, the people in a particular group have among one another, if they're just two people in the scene, and it centers around people. That's the major thing. The photojournalism orientation centers around people and the stories that you can see if you just stand back and watch. I spent time, for example, I would walk around at lunchtime just without a camera, just looking at people and imagining what was happening in exchange of two people, you know, contacting one another. I'm thinking of a scene right now where a lady is sweeping the sidewalk, and this man evidently walked up to her, and she continued sweeping, you know, and it's just to grab, try to see what might be what Cartier-Bresson called the decisive moment for that particular contact.
And in your own photos, for example, you have a photo on the front. Carmen McRae is on the cover.
Wow. Oh, yeah. She, for me, the kind of classic profile of her. I've taken a lot of pictures of her, and the kind of classic, almost, well, it's a cliche for some people, Egyptian-type orientation and physiognomy, if you will. The shape of her face and everything is just so classic. And the feel, the way she treated her songs. I mean, she was a person who, and this is why I hooked into her, so to speak, she was a person who almost always used the verse, the introduction to a song. So it was always, if you didn't know the verse of a song like Stardust, you wouldn't even recognize it if you had never heard it before. But when she moved from that verse, that introduction, right. I mean, it was just, I mean, all that feeling was right there. And actually, difficult as impossible as it is to really catch the sound thing, it was to try to get some graphic image of what the artist, in this instance, Carmen McRae, was sharing with us.
Her enunciation in vocalizing was always so crystal clear as well.
Leaving me a love that will not die. Love is now the stardust of yesterday. The music of the years gone by.
With singers, it's telling the story.
Yes.
Delivering a story. It's not about how cute you are or how clever you are, but get the story over.
Yes.
So tell us the story of this photo here of Carmen McRae. You saw her in the Longshoremen's Hall, and she was one of your first subjects, Charlie.
Well, actually, she was sitting at a raggedy, I don't know how else to describe it, a raggedy upright piano with her back to me, and it was on in the rail of a stage. The old Longshoremen's Hall in San Francisco still exists, but the Longshoremen long ago built the new hall. But just to hear her playing, first of all, I didn't know who she was. She at that time was, and I can't tell you off the top of my head what year that was. I'm sure it was in the 50s. But just to hear her playing and doodling on the piano, and I couldn't get a frontal view of her because she was up against the wall. And I didn't really want to interrupt it, and that's another one of my commitments, is not to interfere, you know, in some kind of way, detract or be some barrier to the artist's communication or playing.
In the stardust of a sound, beside a garden.
And now you mentioned the Longshoremen's Hall in San Francisco.
Yes.
The two of you met a long time back there in the Berkeley. You were both part of the jazz scene.
Oh, yeah.
Back in 1962. What was that scene like?
Al, you want to speak to that?
It was quite vibrant. Jazz was taken for granted back then. That is, it was a part of everything that was going on in American life. It wasn't an exotic little side gym the way that it's become since it's become a conservatory music.
Yeah.
But it was very active. The music was still being created. And even people who didn't like jazz pretended to like jazz because they knew that something was missing. Right. They were perceived as being non-jazz lovers. So that it was very exciting. There were clubs everywhere, and you had a lot of local jazz. You had, I know over here in Berkeley, you had places like Mandrakes and little clubs that never made big reputations, but named people would often appear there for a night, sometimes a couple of nights.
Any night of the week.
Yes, and it was a neighborhood kind of thing. You could go through San Francisco, and there were neighborhood bars and clubs that featured jazz and blues music.
You actually start the book with possibly my three favorites, if I could have three favorites.
Okay.
And that's Monk, Duke Ellington, and Charlie Mingus.
Oh, yes.
And Mingus, you say in the book, he refers to, including himself, MDM, Monk, Duke, and Mingus.
Yes.
Is there a thematic connection between them all?
Yes, they all are the progeny of Duke Ellington.
Yes.
In other words, Duke Ellington is the cement in the middle there, but he's the Duke. And Monk and Mingus, this is Mingus's conception. He actually has a musical selection on one of his albums called MDM. He saw Thelonious Monk and himself as being the prime exponents of the Ellingtonian approach to music. But I would also toss in Gil Evans, the wonderful arranger who is behind a lot of Miles Davis's orchestral successes.
Mm-hmm. I actually saw Monk back when I was 18 years old, and that was a really long time ago.
Okay. I don't believe that.
Well, it wasn't maybe as long ago as it was for you, but it was at the Village Vanguard in New York. Tell me about your experience of him.
Well, Charles has a wonderful story about how he shot that very imminent photograph in jazz idiom.
Well, first of all, this was backstage at Monterey, and Monterey Jazz Festival, and we were going up. I was at the top of the stairs to the stage, and Monk was coming up the stairs, and this was his LBJ phase. You could almost tell vintage-wise what year it is by the hat Monk was wearing. Or at the time, okay? And so what he has on is that, I'll call it that stingy brim 1 gallon hat of LBJ, okay? And I asked him I said, T, would you hold still for a moment for me? I'd like to get a real close-up. And he kind of looked at me and ground his teeth, because he was kind of a teeth grinder, if you will. And he said, he kind of grunted. And he sat still. I mean, I only took a couple minutes, of course, and the good feeling that I had was, like, he kind of gave me such a warm response, I didn't even get nervous. Okay? Because in a situation like that, the first thing that fails on you is focusing, okay, if you get nervous, all right? But just to have him respond warmly, and then following that, and probably was a year or two later, Art Auerbach, who owned the
Jazz Workshop
in North Beach in San Francisco, actually had Monk there because Monk appeared there several times, and I told him that I had this headshot close-up of Monk, and he actually bought the picture from me. I framed it, of course, and hung the picture near the front door, and during intermission, one of the intermissions, whatever day it was, and Monk had only been there a day or so, and we were out in front of the club doing intermission, and I asked Monk, how do you like the photograph that I did of you? And I really didn't expect him to remember it, that I, you know, who I was, et cetera. And he said, and of course, part of the jazz lore is to put people on, okay? Pretend that you, whatever, all right? He said, what photograph? I said, oh, T, come on, don't do that to me. You know, I know you saw the picture. The picture's right there at the entrance, and there's only one way in the club. Okay, and I pretended to be, you know, disgusted with it. So he walked over across the sidewalk, looked at it, went into his teeth grinding again, and then looked down at me, because Monk is a tall man, taller than me anyway, okay? He looked down at me and said, oh, man, that's nice.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with poet Al Young and photographer Charlie Robinson about their book and CD set, Jazz Idiom. It's out from Heyday Press. Thank you. how about the great Sir Duke Ellington? You've already mentioned him. He's like the father of so many jazz yes. musicians in many ways. Al, I wonder if you could read us the poem that you wrote to Monk that's in the book, the riff to Ellington.
Yeah.
To Ellington.
Oh, my goodness. Let's see. Yes. Duke Ellington, 1899-1974. Why, Sir Duke, did you spend so much time sitting up all night, writing music until dawn, making all those gigs and trotting the globe when you could have kicked back and retired on your massive song royalties?
Yes.
At the height of the Great Depression, your royalty earnings ran close to $1 million a year. Ballads, suites, epics, ballet, opera, what didn't you undertake? How did it feel to have to fire Mingus after he and Juan Tiso, your beloved saxophonist, got in a fight? Puerto Rico-born, Tiso had written the classic Perdido, whose title in English means lost. Your New Mexico-born, thin-skinned, deep-thinking bass player hauled out a fire axe on Tiso, and Tiso a machete. Tiso's an old problem, you had to tell Mingus. Why don't you resign? You're a new problem. In one of your rare lyrics, you say, there's two kinds of woman, two kinds of man, two kinds of romance since time began. There's real true love and that good old jive. One tries to kill you, one helps to keep you alive. I don't know what kind of blues I've got. America's most prolific and terrific composer. You did love us madly after all, didn't you? I didn't know I was going to do that.
I'm glad you did. What about Mary Lou Williams? Tell us who she was.
Al, why don't you deal with that?
Well, Mary Lou Williams was a prodigy in Kansas City. She was actually arranging and composing music at the age of 12 and 13. And by her account, the great Art Tatum, the blind pianist, master jazz pianist, came to town and when she was around 13 or 14 years old. And she says she was pointed out because she had family in the music business, and she was a prodigy and featured with a lot of bands. And she showed Tatum some special stuff that she had come up with on piano. And she swears that Tatum later incorporated this into his own repertoire without giving her credit. But she was writing arrangements for bands out there in the what they call the territory bands, Andy Kurt and Clouds of Joy, while she was still in her teens. And she was a masterful a teacher. She is responsible for teaching Errol Garner a lot about piano, and also Thelonious Monk, and also Bud Powell, who's the sort of Thelonious Monk's disciple.
Right.
So that Mary Lou Williams has an influence on jazz that has gone largely unacknowledged, I think, because she was a woman. And she sort of stayed in the background. But the amazing thing about me to her is that she was always modern. From the early days of being a child prodigy, early in the 20th century, until her last days, she always sounded like right now. Whether the style was swing, whether it was boogie-woogie, whether it was bebop, or she even did a recording with Cecil Taylor, who was regarded as being the avant-garde enfant terrible, and she kept up with him. In fact, surpassed him.
Yeah, really.
Well, and so she was really on the leading edge.
Yes.
Always.
Yes.
Now, Charlie, you say that she reminded you of Ralph Bunche. Tell us who he was. And why she reminded you of him. I found that a striking comparison there.
I had an opportunity. First of all, she was a woman that carried herself with a lot of dignity. The reason I made that comparison, I had an opportunity to spend maybe 15 or 20 minutes in the cloakroom of the Greek Theater at the University of California with Ralph Bunche and the valet, just the three of us. He was to make a presentation. He was the envoy for the United States to the United Nations Assembly. And actually, secretary. If I can
yes, just, he was secretary.
Yeah, right, right.
General of the United, yeah. of the United Nations.
And it, was he the first African American to be in a position like
yes,
that at
was.
The UN?
Absolutely.
Yep, yeah, oh, yeah, right. But the dignity and the humility that they both kind of shared, and I'm sure they've met one another since they were in New York. But I just saw a linkage, and one of the things that happens in watching people, you see a common ground. I mean, you can feel the kind of, well, I keep going back to dignity, and that's really not an adequate description, but the kind of mixed with humility and the confidence that they have in themselves, and they don't exude any kind of arrogance, you know. And when you have people in leadership roles, whether it's Mary Lou Williams or Ralph Munch, and you see that mix where you know that the person is confident in what they're capable of doing, what they know, what leadership they exhibit, they still maintain that humility, which means that they're always open to new information.
Nina Simone is another musician in the book Jazz Idiom. I asked Al Young and Charlie Robinson about her.
Well, for me, Nina, and of course in recent weeks, months, the whole concept of Maverick has been really abused. But she was a person, a performer, who you dare not classify from the standpoint of her approach to music. She was kind of... I'll call it omnibus, if you will, eclectic in her approach. I mean, she'd be a folk singer in one moment and a classical pianist a chorus later.
Classical music.
And that's what she was trained as. And a strong personality, committed to her role in doing message songs. I mean, she gave new flavor to even a couple of the Beatles songs in the sense that... The Beatles were great in their melodic lines, but one of the things that would always come up short for me on the Beatles is that they'd give you the melody and then the song was over. okay.
Well, she talked about what she was doing. I mean, even right there, I remember seeing her in a, I actually saw her in an absolutely jam-packed high school gym in Dayton, Ohio. In 1966 or 67.
That was a good year.
Yeah. It was 67, I believe it was. And she really, you know, that there was an education there as well as terrific music.
Yes. And anything she wanted to play, she could play.
Both she and Thelonious Monk are Carolinians, North Carolinians, and so was John Coltrane.
Now, Al, you wrote something beautiful about Nina Simone, too, and that's on page 62.
Yes. Rooted in the blue-black soil of her Carolina girlhood, she was the diva. She could purr and roar.
Uh-huh.
She could dive and soar, and more. You didn't play with Nina, not unless you could go her distance. And what delicious twisting distances they are. If you couldn't run with the sun, send sound underground, or swim her troubled waters, you couldn't play with Nina Simone. You might get hurt.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole round world to hear.
I think we got just enough time for one more great, and that's Miles Davis.
Oh, boy.
I want to say first, this is an incredible photograph. Talk about that photograph, where you took it first, Charlie Robinson.
Well, I think that one was also at the Monterey Jazz Festival. And for me, I watched Miles over about 3 years. I'll call it metamorph, if you will, in his dress. Miles along with a lot of, practically speaking, all of them, I think I will agree, all of the jazz musicians, they weren't clothes hogs, but they always wanted to be clean. And that meant natural shoulder, three-button suit, pants legs with a straight cut to it, just barely touching the top of the shoes, that sort of thing.
Clean in the vernacular sense, not in the sanitary sense.
Right, exactly.
Clean
for you younger listeners.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I watched them move from that to the continental suit, which had a different cut to it and was tighter fitting, and the move to the leather, the suede jacket that he has on in the photograph. And the next year, Miles was trying to catch up with kind of the hippie dress and the hippie popularity. Then finally, which I have some photographs of too, which I won't print, okay, because that's my morality, with the strings hanging down from his sleeves like a cowboy, you know.
Why do you say that that's your morality? Why wouldn't you want to print that?
Well, because my judgment is that I have him, in psychiatry it's called time binding, I have him fixed in time in the continental, not the continental, but the natural shoulder three-button suit, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Ivy League style.
Italian.
No,
his bands were always the best-dressed bands.
Yes.
People would show up quite often not to hear the music, but to see what the band would be wearing.
Okay. So the Miles picture is really, for me, just one phase, and his gesture and his bent body suggests how he would bend notes, you know.
That's right. There's a range of tone here.
Uh-huh.
You know, at one point you call Johnny Hodges master of tone, or maybe that's your expression, Alan.
Yes.
I'm not sure which one.
Right.
And you've got different tones here also. So maybe I will just say something about that.
Yeah. Actually, for melodic lines, I'm tempted to call it sweetness of Johnny Hodges. I mean, his approach to the same instrument differs from some other alto player in that his approach to the melody is quite, everything kind of blends together, and not in the sense to make it less now, but you can see the connection between all of the phrases. I mean, you could have another alto player who's a little harsher in their approach. It could still blend together, but their personality kind of makes them have a different attack, if you will, almost, to a particular song. And if you heard the same song by two or three, and I mean, this is common knowledge, of course, the same song by two or three different artists, you could hear the personality. One of the things that makes it easy for us that have been listening to this stuff for a long time, we could hear from a particular artist maybe just three notes and say that's so-and-so-and-so-and-so. Because we know the tonality with which they attack a song, you know.
Well, you know, that brings it back to both of you.
Yeah.
You, Charlie Robinson, you are a visual artist.
Yes.
Al Young, although you have a wonderful, wonderful voice, I mean, your poetry is music, but
yes,
you are a writer. How does tone express itself in your work? As jazz musicians, how do you bring that idea of tone as jazz aficionados into the expression of your own art?
Well, the language is my instrument. When I teach poetry, for example, I like to tell my prospective poets or ambitious poets that they owe it to themselves to learn the language, that poetry is to the rest of writing as the piano is to the rest of music, and some knowledge of poetry and its techniques, how to use metaphor, how to use sound, how to use pleasing sound combinations or discordant sound combinations, if that's your purpose in expressing something, is totally essential to writing well, whether you're writing an essay or a novel or a term paper or an annual report. And we forget that language is musical and that it comes to us in the form of music when we're very, very young, when we're learning nursery rhymes and learning to speak, as it were. People tend to fall back on corporate-driven and politically-driven phrases that mean nothing. Free trade and preemptive strike and plausible deniability and this kind of thing. And to actually be able to think clearly, you need language that's fresh and, I would say, musical. So from a very early age in my household, anyway, just listening to people tell stories and reading, bringing these two realms together, the written word and the spoken word, I started to see that the relationship between speech and text, that text is to be spoken before it, like musical scores are to be sounded, for them to make any sense or to have any resonance. And the human body is the instrument for the delivery of that performance. Does that make sense?
Oh, that does. And then how about when you're doing something that's actually visual, Charlie? Mm-hmm. Does tone enter into your work as well?
Absolutely. One of the things in my kind of self-training, one of the things I used to do was walk around again without a camera and a light meter, measuring the light in various settings and training myself to see the difference without the meter later on in the tones. A gray tone has a different feel in a shadow than it does in the bright sunlight. So I'm always trying to, if there's a particular part of the image that I want to emphasize, I want to be sure that it is lighter in tone because your eye will go to that first, when you go into a frame to look at an image, your eye will always be attracted to the lighter tone first. And that doesn't mean it has to be white or near white, but a shade of gray in black and white photography, a shade of gray that's lighter than what's in the shadow. And you may even also want to show a relationship between something that's in a darker tone that you won't see unless you read the photograph. So I might hide something. Sometimes I won't see it until I print it up, that I didn't see it when I actually took the photograph. That's something in the background, you know, that's related to what I'm concentrating on, maybe in the foreground, you know. But the tone, when I print, make a print, then I want to be sure that what I want to be emphasized is in fact emphasized, and if something that's in a shadow that I don't want to be lost, that it's not lost.
Well, that is wonderful. Thank you so much, Charlie Robinson and Al Young for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you, Francesca.
And we want to thank you for the opportunity to share, okay?
Photographer Charlie Robinson and poet Al Young. Their book is Jazz Idiom, Blueprints, Stills, and Frames. Coming up, we talk with Eugene Jarecki about the American way of war. This is Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The stated purpose of the military is to protect and defend the United States. It's also supposed to protect democracy. Every soldier swears fealty to the Constitution. But in his book, The American Way of War, Eugene Jarecki says the purpose of the military has more to do with feeding the bottom line of military contractors than defending the country. It's the military-industrial complex. When President Eisenhower coined that term in 1956, he really wanted to add the word congressional to it. Jarecki says it's that unholy alliance between the military, the contractors, and the Congress that's putting our democracy in peril. Jarecki's book was inspired by his film, Why We Fight, which won the 2005 Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival. He's also founder and director of the public policy organization, the Eisenhower Project. Your book, The American Way of War, Guided Missiles, Misguided Men, and a Republican Peril, went the reverse route from film to book rather than the other way around. It begins with President Dwight David Eisenhower's 1961 farewell address, the famous one, in which he warns Americans to guard against the military-industrial complex. Now, I've heard that he wanted to add congressional to the military-industrial. Is that true?
Yes, in the original drafts of the farewell address, Eisenhower's formulation had indeed been military-industrial-congressional complex, because he was keenly aware of the role that, of course, Congress inevitably plays in sort of making possible this corruption of our system.
Corruption of our system. I mean, the congressional is a key part of that, and a major point of your book is how this system has corrupted our democracy.
Yes.
Can you lay out just maybe some of the broad outlines of that first before we dive more into the meat of the book?
Sure. I mean, there's no question that when I started out, what I got from Eisenhower as inspiration was his comments about the military-industrial complex. But the deeper I looked and the more I learned things like his focus on Congress and his focus on other forms of corruption and just the broad sort of sweeping view he had of the dangers of what he called the power of money is ever present and is gravely to be regarded, that what he was focusing on was really something much larger, a kind of corporate political complex that has come to imperil our capacity as a society to live up to our Republican ideals, that small r, like a republic.
Now, as I understand this, the origins, I mean, industrial capitalism has been around in this country since perhaps the 1830s,
yes,
but that this military industrial capitalism really got going during World War II, or perhaps even before in the build-up to that.
It did, but I want to point out that it's almost unfair to single out the military-industrial sector as if it's the root of all evil in Washington. The fact is, this is far larger. This is simply about corporate power and the fact that corporate power makes Congress people professional pleaders on behalf of the corporations that are their benefactors in their districts. And who they plead to is ultimately the executive. And since you know that the executive favors war, that makes the Congress people vulnerable to the war-making wishes of the executive. So to give you a silly example for this, you know, it's one thing when we talk about defense expenditure and we say, isn't it ridiculous that we spend such and such on a toilet seat or such and such on a hammer? But let's take a more interesting example, the F-22 fighter. The F-22 fighter has a piece of it made in 45 U.S. states. Now, I only took Econ 101, but something tells me that that's not an efficient way to build an aircraft. But it is a smart way to build an aircraft if what you're looking to do is to build it in such a way that nobody can shut down the flow of money to your system. Because by putting it in so many states and a majority of congressional districts, what you're doing is making it so that when somebody questions the F-22 and says, is this a worthy program, everybody in Congress is getting a piece of the action. And so they fall awfully quiet when those questions arise. Now, this is bad enough because it leads to bad expenditure. I mean, think about it. The F-22 is an air-to-air combat aircraft. We don't have an enemy with an air force, and we've spent $70 billion on it at a time of enormous financial collapse. So when you start to see these inane decisions and you wonder, well, it's bad enough that we're wasting the money, the next question is, well, does it lead to war? And I argue that whether it's an F-22 being made in your district or whether it's an aspirin maker in your district or a media company in your district, the fact that the congressperson has to plead on their behalf, which is a flaw in our system that was unanticipated and must be fixed, the fact that they have to do that is what makes them vulnerable ultimately to the slippery slope toward war that comes with executive power.
And you call this political engineering.
It is.
You've said what is common between the defense industry and other capitalist industries,
sure,
but what makes it special?
Well, again, I don't want to single it out because it's a mistake. If people think that the military-industrial complex means that there are warmongers working at defense companies and it's their special relationship with military brass that leads us to war, I think that's a grave misunderstanding because, in fact, this last war in Iraq was run by civilians. And it was the generals in many cases, like General Shinseki, who were saying, I don't see it. Show me the evidence. Show me why we're doing this. Show me how it's going to work. So in many ways, you have to have an understanding of this that's more comprehensive, that includes basically a dynamical understanding of how corporate power compromises the purity of congressional decision-making, and by doing so, makes congressional figures quiet when crucial votes come, puts them in a conflict of interest. Give you an example. Let's say on a Monday, you're a congressperson, and that F-22 is made in your district. So you call the executive branch. And the reason you're calling the executive branch on a Monday is because you want to lobby the executive branch for continued support for the F-22 program because the maker is in your district. Well, the reason you have to call the executive branch is that that's where the Department of Defense is. Because ever since World War II, almost all of the major agencies that guide national spending priorities are housed in the executive branch. So you call the DOD and you say, you know, the good people of my district work very hard on the F-22. We know there are people who question its legitimacy in a post-Cold War world, but, you know, you never know what the future might bring, and the good people in my district really care about this as a part of America's arsenal. We hope you'll take that under advisement, Mr. Rumsfeld, when the next vote comes up. And so the DOD says to you, thank you a lot for your call. We, too, share an interest in the F-22. We don't want to see it go either, but, of course, we got to look at a lot of systems. But we sure do value you and your constituents for the hard work they're doing. Thanks for the call. That's on a Monday. On Tuesday, the phone rings, and it's another member of the executive branch. This time, it's the president. And he says to you, Congressman, I think there might be WMDs in Iraq. And if I feel the need to take action, I'm hoping I can count on your support. Well, just yesterday, you were the one asking for a favor. So how strongly are you going to do your Jeffersonian duty and say, Mr. President, you show me the evidence of those WMDs?
Well, that is a powerful example there. You talked about how civilians are really running the defense industry, and we've seen, especially under this administration, this last 8 years, a tremendous increase in the privatization of the defense industry, of the conducting of war. How does that change things?
This is the same American affliction deep down in our soul that's manifesting itself in all kinds of symptoms around the body politic. So you have an affliction, which is that this system is corrupt and broken in the inside. And that's why the levies weren't up to scratch. That's why the economy is crashing. That's why we have a population that's insufficiently educated to compete in the global space. That's why we have uninsured people. We have so many areas that you could look at and say, ah, there's a symptom. And usually what it comes down to is that part of our national affliction is a Kool-Aid that everybody drank with Ronald Reagan, that where we started to believe that the public good can be left to the private sector to take care of. That's trickle-down. And trickle-down is nonsense. And we've just seen it play out in the crash of the marketplace. Reagan should by now have his stock price begin to finally lower, because that stuff, that idea that if the rich people just make themselves richer and richer, somehow it'll benefit the rest of us, that is not playing out. And so what that tells me is that when you look at the privatization of military functions, it's just the same old idea again. Leave it to the powerful, and the rest of us will be taken care of. Well, try telling that to the soldiers who didn't get body armor in Iraq, while our private contractor counterparts were covered in body armor and well taken care of, fed, and paid. And so that privatization of military functions has a legion of disastrous implications and consequences. But the first and most glaring one is that gulf that you see between the sort of quality of care and quality of approach taken with the private that, of course, never trickles down to the public, the private, sergeant or private or major in the field who's dealing with real life and death situations and is underprepared compared to his private counterparts.
We're talking with Eugene Jarecki about his first film and now book, The American Way of War. Now, those same powerful that you just mentioned often say, as do many others, that the defense industry drives the economy, is good for the economy. For example, many people talk to World War II and say that it was the war that got us out of the Depression, not Roosevelt's social programs. What's your take on this? Is the role of the defense economy a good one, or does that also drag down the economy?
I think it's just the defense business justifying itself. I think the mafia would tell you that violence does them good, too. That doesn't mean it's moral or that it has a sustainable long-term vision. So this country, if it operates on a Keynesian idea of militarism as a engine for economic growth, will find that Eisenhower is right and they are wrong. That Eisenhower said you cannot let a society be misguided in its national priorities toward an excess of militarism. George Washington said it too, that ultimately the cost of that, Eisenhower is a wonderful phrase, you know, what he depicts is a society that can run away with itself in its own hysteria. Eisenhower was very clear in his time, both as a general and then president, that, as he said, you can never have perfect security. No nation can have it any more than the rest of us know that we could walk out our front door and get hit by a car. And we don't hyper-securitize our lives. We don't, therefore, not leave the house. We don't walk around with body armor in case of that. We just take that risk. We understand it's an imperfect world. Well, governments, because it serves them and it serves the powerful, very often get the people worked into a lather in the pursuit of perfect security, into a paranoid, hysteric frenzy. And since you can never have perfect security, along the way what you can do is bankrupt yourself trying to achieve it, which is what we're watching right now. And so I only raise this because the idea that we should lean on militarization as an engine for social growth, and there's no question that, sure, if you have any industry that you pour a great deal of public resources into, whether it's building bridges or building bombs, it's going to have a productive outcome. And Barack Obama, for example, has suggested that he wants to do this with a kind of green revolution. You can point to anything. It's just the defense sector has been ruling the roost for the last half century, and so they've been able to say, hey, look at the kind of growth we've produced, and I would say that's because that's where we put our money.
Well, talking about the green revolution as opposed to a war economy,
sure.
I heard Barney Frank, Congressman Barney Frank, answering a reporter's question on how are we going to pay for the bailouts, pay for a green economy. He answered it by pointing to the cost of war, and he said few question the necessity for those costs. Now, do you think he's just playing to the base, or do you think that there is any spine for cutting military costs?
Oh, goodness. I mean, Barney Frank recently called for a 25% cut in defense spending, which, as military analysts will tell you, can actually be undertaken without reducing America's effective defense at all, not 1%. So there is a tremendous amount of profligacy and downright corrupt nonsense going on in the defense sphere. And if you look at what we spend on defense, which is more than the rest of the world combined and more than all other parts of our discretionary federal budget combined, surely you would do the society a great deal of good to simply, you know, tighten up the corruption that exists in that sphere. But I have to say, I think something more systemic and deep-seated is going on. I'm not comfortable with these bailouts, and I'm largely not comfortable because I'm not a Democrat or a Republican who is sitting in Congress on the payroll of a system that has a fundamentally corrupt vision of national priorities and national governance. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, there is something about these bailouts that smacks to all of us like a double standard. Like one day, you're a poor person in America, and you're a working person, or you're a mom and pop who own a little grocery or a shoe store, and you're told for years and years that the reason you're not further along and higher up the food chain is that it's a survival of the fittest, and the big boys are just fitter than you are, but good luck. You're also told, if you're poor, for example, that the little bit of a social safety net you're getting in your welfare check or your unemployment or your whatever little help you're getting, if there is much for you, is a gigantic drain on the system. And now here we are this many years later, and it turns out when the rich and powerful collapse, when their car wash goes belly up or their shoe store goes belly up, there's a golden safety net for them. And on top of the golden safety net, it seems as though Darwin suddenly goes out the window and we no longer think about it as survival of the fittest. So there is something really pernicious at work. And when you see both parties lining up in their own way to sort of score points on this, it's the business as usual of being in Washington. And you'll notice, well, this week it's the guys who have a benefit from the auto industry. Last week it was the guys who are tied into Wall Street.
Now, I'd like to ask you a question that often is not asked, and that is about the environmental costs of war in economic terms. How do they translate into a drag on the economy?
Sure. I mean, you know, you have to think about it this way. Eisenhower's vision of the military-industrial complex is a vision of a person who was both a military conservative and a fiscal conservative. And he understood that those go hand in glove, because basically part of the reason the framers were afraid of foreign entanglements was not only that they can make the executive too powerful, because every time there's a problem anywhere in the world, he suddenly starts saying, hey, there's no habeas corpus, there's no more constitution, I'll leave everything up to me. They didn't want that. But they also were afraid of the other ravages that war brings to our liberties, but also to the health of our society. And it's Eisenhower who puts the finest point on this when in 1953, 8 years before he gave his farewell address, he makes a speech called the Chance for Peace speech, where he says, effectively, he shows the comparison between what we spend on given weapon systems and what that costs us in the health of our republic in other ways. So he says, the cost of one modern heavy bomber is this, a modern brick school in over 30 cities. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is this many bushels of wheat. It's incredibly poignant, the speech. And by doing that comparison, he shows the sort of standoff between guns and butter. Well, the environment is our modern butter. It's one of those issues that when you are putting your money disproportionately toward defense, you are not putting it toward a more indirect, but no less important, fundamental need at a national level. So what Eisenhower teaches us at the end of the day is that you have to have a comprehensive vision of national security, that a nation's strength is her security, and a nation's strength is about more than just bombs. You have to have a nation that is surviving the environment to even be alive to fight another day. You have to have an educated population, because if the population is uneducated, they're unfit for war. If a population is unhealthy, they're unfit for war. If a population has failing infrastructure, not only are they drowning in the streets, but our rivals in the world see that as the weakness that invites more aggression. This goes on and on. What Eisenhower is ultimately saying is that the best answer to 9/11 would not have been some hysterical and ultimately rather embarrassing show of force, but the best idea would have been to have some measure of military action combined with other decisions, like after 9/11 we could have fortified our healthcare system, we could have fortified our education system, we could have fortified our environmental approaches, we could have made ourselves a place of tomorrow where it would become that much harder to recruit against us. There are so many ways in which a nation's strength is defined, and all too often, because it's convenient to those who benefit from it, we are only fed by the powerful the most simplistic expression of national power, which is using weapons.
And of course, this is very early after the election,
sure.
So we still, you know, Barack Obama is not yet the president.
Right.
What are the winds that you're feeling blowing in terms of the issues that you bring
sure.
to the fore with your book?
Well, the issues in my book reveal to anyone who reads it, I hope, how unbelievably deep-seated the corruption in Washington is and how it does not belong to one party or another. The Republicans aren't more corrupt or more war-making than the Democrats. The last century brought us as many wars run by Democrats as Republicans, and I will remind us all that under this sort of adage that bad things happen when good people do nothing, if somebody has a lot of belief in the Democrats, you have to ask yourself why these people let this entire calamity happen in the last 8 years. Where was the outrage indeed? So now I'm looking at a situation where we have Barack Obama in. There's a whole new moment that feels like it might be afoot. But be very careful. Do not be fooled. The forces in Washington don't care that Barack Obama is a very decent person and a deep person and a thoughtful person. All the things you can feel from watching him not take cheap shots as a candidate, for example. It doesn't care. It will chew him up and spit him out so quickly that our heads will spin if we, the public, are not doggedly and unrelentingly exerting our pressure as a force demanding change from below. No change in human history has ever been trickled down, any more than in any economy has ever been trickled down.
Well, then, how concretely could one rein in, I mean, aside
sure.
from the kind of popular movement that is needed to bring about reforms in that direction, what specific reforms would you have to cut the ties between this defense establishment and the political power structure?
Clean money movements in politics all across the country, simply cutting the cord by which corporate America is able to basically, let's just call it what it is able to basically bribe and use money to curry favor with congressional leadership. The other side of that, of course, is that what they also do is what you mentioned earlier, political engineering. Do you know that the defense industry, and it has now spread to other industries, when they want to make something like the B-1 bomber, a piece of it is made in every single U.S. state, that should be illegal. There should simply be a very clean money motivation within our members of Congress that is made irrepressible because the public demands it, that says if you're going to get federal funding, we're going to look at how you're going to deploy the money. And if it looks like you're deploying the money to build a constituent, not to build a better plane, that's illegal. So those are two areas we could do, but it has to do with everyday people learning about these things by reading on the Internet, reading books like mine, reading books like Andrew Bacevich's The Limits of Power, getting these kind of thoughts going in our minds and then sharing it with those we care about, sharing it with others who we don't know, so that these groupings start to grow into a kind of Congress Watch in any district in America. If you had as many people in Congress Watch groups in districts in this country as you have in bird watching groups, you would have a completely different country.
That's a wonderful suggestion. Well, Eugene Jarecki, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
The book is The American Way of War, Guided Missiles, Misguided Men, and a Republican Peril. Eugene Jarecki is also a filmmaker. In addition to his documentary, Why We Fight, he's produced The Trials of Henry Kissinger, Quest of the Carib Canoe, and other works.
War makes war. It won't bring peace. Just makes more without cease. Peace will come from what is right. Peace will come from just the strength to stop the red, red wheel, to make it lock and rust, to make it lock and rust. We can learn from everyone how to or not to be. But we can learn the most from those who think differently. Who think differently. War makes war. Won't bring peace. From the Book of Amos, the words went into the dream. Let justice run down like water, righteousness like a mighty stream. Righteousness like a mighty stream. Still believe that there is hope. If love is where our trust is, the arc of the moral long, but it bends towards justice. But it bends towards justice. War makes war. It won't bring peace. It just makes more. Without cease.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.